I do. I think they're the most important bits of green infrastructure out there because everyone is interacting with them every day, whereas not everyone goes to the park and not everyone goes to the Botanic Garden and, you know, not everyone goes hiking, things like this, whereas everyone goes to the supermarket.
Welcome to the Underground Podcast. I'm Kate, the gardener guru, horticulture consultant and writer and presenter on all things gardening.
And I'm Phil, co-founder of Right O'Bara, a creative marketing agency for the home and garden sectors. Join us in conversation with those people shaping the UK's garden care industry.
So without further ado,
let's get down and dirty. Hi there, Kate.
Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
I am good, thank you very much. And I am very excited because we're about to start a new series, a mini series within the Underground, which is going to be quite exciting, I think, and right up my street for sure, because I don't know whether you know this, Kate, but I actually studied architecture.
Well, you did tell me that ages ago, but I must admit I have forgotten. So yeah, right up your street, literally.
Yeah. So this series, not looking at buildings, but we're actually going to be looking at how green spaces interact with the urban environment, with the built environment.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And not just, we're not just talking parks and gardens, are we? We're talking about all different, you know, we're looking at new builds, especially we're looking at, well, what's the word you use? I really like it.
So the spaces in between.
The spaces in between. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. So that they're all the things like, car park borders and verges,
roundabouts, all these kind of things
that bring in that green environment into the urban space.
Well, that can just lift an area, no matter where it is, you know, whether it's a street corner, whether it's a really heavily built up environment, or as we said, new builds. So yeah, and we're going to be talking to a chap that I'm really interested in talking to, Tom Angel, who is a horticulturist and a landscaper, but he comes very much from the kind of landscape contractor background, from property maintenance, working with property managers, and he's got a really interesting story to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. He has actually written his thesis on these often overlooked spaces and how to how the fact that actually they have been neglected quite a lot by property managers, and that they're often seen as a drain on resources, but they actually add so much to the built environment and the environment that we live in.
Absolutely. So mainly we're going to concentrate on spaces that are generally neglected, not looked after, that you don't think of as a fantastic place to kind of have biodiversity. But that's what we kind of want to talk about. It doesn't matter how big, how built up your environment is, there is room and there always will be room for nature, and there will always be the ability to kind of have that green space to make you feel better. And I think we really looked at that as a nation during the pandemic. We saw how important the green spaces were to everyone. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to this little mini series.
Yeah. So let's have a chat with Tom. We're delighted to welcome onto the podcast today, Tom Angel, a horticultural consultant and landscape designer. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Kate.
Lovely to meet you.
You too. You too. I'm glad to be here.
So I'm going to go straight into it, Tom. Not today, but you generally seem to wear a lot of different hats. Can you give us a bit of the background about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. No, I suppose I do a little bit these days. They kind of make sense in my mind, so I'll try and provide a bit of clarity on that. So I trained as a geographer originally, and kind of fell into horticulture a little bit later on, kind of later in my 20s. So I ended up working for a landscape construction company in London. And I moved to Scotland after a while and ended up worked as a gardener for a long time, and then ended up running a contracting business for quite a number of years. And And then after that, I closed that business down in the end and retrained in garden design and started doing the RHS Master of Horticulture Award. And I used that to delve into the issues I'd seen in the landscape maintenance contracting world. And strangely enough, it kind of seemed to do a big circle back around to geography, because it's human geography I did, like people in cities and how people are interacting with their environment. So it seemed to do a big circle to me, and it's all making sense now.
All right, fantastic.
Whereabouts in Scotland are you, Tom?
Glasgow. So my work takes me all over. So I end up down south for work sometimes as well, but I'm based in Glasgow these days, yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Love it up there. Love it.
So Tom, what inspired your interest in utilitarian landscapes? We're going to come on to that, I think, in a little bit. And how has your perspective evolved from your experience as a landscape maintenance contractor to now being more of a consultant designer?
Yeah, like it's interesting because, like, I appreciate it sounds exceptionally niche, you know, my interest in the kind of utilitarian. I really enjoyed the term you used, Phil, of the in-between spaces, you know. Right. Yeah. Because I think it's such a good description, because very much what I'm interested in is not the bits that get lots of attention, not the municipal parks and botanic gardens and things like that. It's the little bits of green infrastructure in the supermarket car park, on the housing estates, the planters in the streets and things like that, you know. And I guess just referencing back my original training, I think that it's not a coincidence that I'm a geographer originally, you know, and so urban horticulture is very relevant to that. But I think my years working with a landscape maintenance contractor, I just saw an industry that's really up against it and is really devalued and, not held in high regard. And in my mind, is doing one of the most important jobs out there, because I genuinely believe those bits of green infrastructure I think they're the most important bits of green infrastructure out there, because everyone is interacting with them every day, whereas not everyone goes to the park and not everyone goes to the botanic garden and, you know, not everyone goes hiking, things like this, whereas everyone goes to the supermarket, you know. And so, like, those bits of green infrastructure where we're getting our proven benefits of quality green space, you know, there's so much research about that, and yet the bits of green infrastructure that people are coming, that most people are coming into contact with on a daily basis, is the bits that look like they don't matter.
Absolutely.
So I know, and I read the article that you wrote last year, which is looking at about these often overlooked spaces, like the verges and car park flower beds and that sort of thing. How do you define the value of these in-between spaces in a broader context of urban and suburban green infrastructure?
These are bits of nature that most people sometimes are the only bits of nature people are coming across, right? So I think that's number one, first and foremost, is where I think their effect lies. But another strand to this, which I think is a really huge issue, actually, and I think should be motivating a bigger response and should be more widely heard, is that we know the likes of municipal parks, you know, as distinct from the types of space that I'm talking about, we know that they're disproportionately interacted with by middle-class white people. Right. And so what that means is we're depriving a large swathe of the population of proven benefits of green infrastructure. All right. So for me, it's not just a horticultural issue, and it's not just a stubborn skills gap in the landscape industry issue. Like, these are really important things, but, like, this is an equalities issue. You know, it's an EDI issue that we that should be really up in arms about, you know. And so I think in terms of social impact, I think that's why it kind of seems so important for me, I guess.
Yeah. And is that disproportionate use of the, of those spaces? Is that through locality to that, to those spaces? You know, that, so, you know, more middle class people are living near the, those parks and that sort of thing? Or is that why you think they're using them more?
I used to live and work in a 70 acre public park. And what you find is that the nearer the park, the house prices go up, don't they? So, I mean, that's, you know, if you've got a nice green space, a bit like a good school, the people that start to move in, the house prices go up. So therefore already you're discriminating, you know, just by wanting to be near that green space. And I certainly noticed that where I used to live, definitely.
That's absolutely spot on, Kate. It's exactly, as you say, like a really good non-private school, all the house prices in the catchment area are through the roof. And so in a way, you know, you've excluded an awful lot of people. So, you know, it's a really perceptive view to home in on that, Phil, you know, because it's, you know, perhaps this is yet another way that we're excluding people. We're making them further away from, you know, or, you know, making it so they're not so accessible to these spaces, you know. So,
yeah. So why do you think then, Tom, that spaces like the car parks, the housing estate landscapes are so often neglected? And, you know, what are the broader consequences of this neglect?
Well, okay, so I did a 10,000-word dissertation on this, Kate. So, like, it's you know, you just have to stop me at some point or another. But I look, so I you know, I boiled it down to a few different relevant factors, which I believe have led to a devaluing and a de-skilling of the grounds maintenance industry. And I think where we are now, there's a common polemic in attacking lazy contractors, operatives mm-hmm. with leaf blowers out. You know, it's really, you know, it's just an easy line to take, all right? Whereas in actual fact, you know, this is a hugely nuanced and complicated issue, and it's one that's got roots going back quite a long time. So outsourcing. You know, this is something, outsourcing of landscape maintenance activities by parks departments, right? So there's academic research which explains that that leads to a decline in standards, right? Right. Now, there's also an awful lot of research about the decline in standards of green infrastructure in the UK, and it traces it back to the 1980s, which is about when outsourcing started to become a thing with council parks departments, all right? So. Yeah. You don't need to take a big leap to connect those two things, all right? So that would be number one. I think within the industry, previously, implementation contractors, so that's the landscapers putting the plants in the ground, they would get tied to a 3-year defects period. That's long enough to get a landscape established, right? It's even long enough to get the trees established. That isn't any longer the case. So typically that would be 1 year. And what will quite often happen is at the end of that 1 year defects period, rather than going for the expense of watering the plants and things like that, at the end of that first year, the dead plants will get replaced and the implementation contractors are gone, right? What that means is the maintenance contractors are then coming in and they might have a relatively new landscape with new plants in. They might not know which ones are new and which ones aren't. So the defects periods, the reduction in defects periods, I think is important. The fact that we don't wash our new landscapes, or very rarely. So even the most drought-tolerant planting schemes, they need watering in their early weeks.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this just isn't happening. It might be getting specified in the landscape architect's instructions, but in reality, it's not happening, right? And so until that becomes something that every contractor is being told you have to quote for this within your bid.
Yeah.
You know, not just everything that's required to establish the plants. They need to say, you need to water these plants for the first 3 months. All right. Mm-hmm. Additionally, an over reliance on generic specifications. I can go into more detail on that, as you can imagine, but you know, we need generic specifications. They're really important, but quite often contractors are ending up being told to work on ones that haven't been written by horticulturists. Okay, so we've got a lot of problems with them.
Yeah.
A general knowledge deficit about horticulture and plants within the property management industries. And of course, you know, they're property managers. They're not horticulturists, you know, but we need in the landscape industry to be really setting ourselves up as experts and going, this is how you look after it, rather than having the big property management companies going, can you just do this? You know, so that would be an issue. Right. Poor tree pit design. So that's something that we know is happening. So poorly designed tree pits.
Sorry, Tom. Tree pits, it's not a phrase that I've come across before. So can you just explain what that is?
Sorry. So those are the holes that trees get planted in.
Fair enough.
What yeah, I mean, that is it, and that is the term for it. And so what there is research about is that too often landscape architects are specifying the design tree pits. So for example, in a supermarket car park where there just isn't enough space for the tree roots. And so you always, even if you plant it really well, you're always going to get a sickly tree in the end or a dead tree because they're not deep enough, you know. So that's something that we know is happening.
Right.
We know trees are getting planted too deeply. And, you know, we're not taking stakes off trees and straps. And then, and finally, the last point there that came up for me was we're missing a trick within the industry with our award schemes, because we have some really good award schemes, but there's some big gaps in them, which is meaning that, again, we know from academic research that award schemes are good upskilling industries, but they need to be good award schemes that work. And we have good award schemes, but like there are some gaps and improvements that could be made in them that could make them work better.
So what are those? What are those gaps that are missing at the minute?
So the Green Flag Award you've probably heard of, because that's one that municipal parks, you know, can put in for.
It's really interesting. Sorry, I'm just interrupting. Just listening to you, because I lived and worked for a council for a long time. I started off as a parkie in Brighton. And just when I started, it was Brighton and Hove City Council. Then it was taken out to a Spanish contractor. Then, and it all went horribly wrong. And then it was brought back in-house. And it was better when it was back in-house. And then when I moved to Surrey Heath again, it was outsourced. So very, very few skilled people with knowledge. You know, you'd have one or two people in charge with the knowledge, but the staff they were working with were just people with leaf blowers and strimmers. And it's really difficult to change that perception, isn't it, of people. And
yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, I mean, you're hitting the nail on the head. It's all that kind of stuff. And, you know, gardeners being seen as a real low level occupation, but you know, the difficulty with that is it's so incredibly nuanced, you know, and in my eyes, we're missing some tricks in how we're looking to tackle it, you know, and certainly in how we're talking about it. But in, you know, in terms of the Green Flag Awards, you know, so residential developments are theoretically able to are eligible for a Green Flag Award, and there's some good examples out there of you know, residential developments where they have been really forward thinking about their green spaces. But you know, imagine if we were able to expand that, and so more of those residential developments were included. All right. And then we start spreading the word a bit more widely than it's already been spread. I think, Kate, you mentioned this earlier about how house prices go up when you're near quality green space. And then all of a sudden, the property industry is able to sell these apartments for a little bit more because they're on a Green Flag awarded site. Right. I don't think that is, you know, completely unrealistic. I think that that's something that could be done. And so, like I say, theoretically, Green Flag Awards can be awarded to residential sites. So that's a kind of education issue, I guess. But commercial sites are not allowed to apply for the Green Flag Award. And actually, there's a really big push due to environmental, social and governance criteria on commercial sites like business parks and stuff like that for really upgrading and concentrating on their green infrastructure. So again, you know, these big blue chip companies that are demanding of their facilities management clients, we want good green infrastructure on their sites, because that is what's happening now. All right. So if they could then turn around and go, oh yeah, so we've got this business park and it's Green Flag awarded the green infrastructure around it. And so your employees can go out for walking meetings on Green Flag awarded green spaces, you know. Again, you know, I just think you need to say the right things to the right people, because I think, you know, for me, it's no good us preaching to the converted and sitting around complaining about why everyone doesn't love plants more, right? Because it's just too easy to do, but it doesn't change anything, right? So we need to go direct to the property management industry and to the property industry and say, look, we can increase the value of your property portfolios, we can increase the value of your properties by having, you know, Green Flag awarded green infrastructure or you know, other ways that we can demonstrate this. But I think it's a real I think we need to tackle it from that angle. And it's not about, oh, because the property industries are full of greedy people and things like that. It's just that we're working in, you know, the realities of commercial world, you know, and we're missing a trick by not really demonstrating to the industries that are giving us the work. We can help you do more, you know?
Yeah. So we've talked a bit about the negatives of neglected spaces. So when these spaces aren't neglected, when they're looked after, you know, what are the benefits? What do you see as being, you know, the good things? Why should people do it?
Well, because for me, do you know, the really powerful thing for me, right, is that people don't need to realize they're benefiting from quality green infrastructure to benefit from it. All right.
Right.
And so it's something else that we can do that we can all be guilty of. Certainly I've been guilty of anyway, you know, as someone that loves nature and loves plants, is, you know, bemoaning people with plant blindness who, you know, they just see green stuff, you know. All right.
Yeah.
But actually we don't need to convince them. Right. I mean, we do on some level, right? Because we need people to part with money to maintain them, and we want them to value them more and stuff like that. But the point I'm making there is we don't need to convince them for them to benefit from them. All right. So I actually think that, you know, we have this duty to upgrade and value the in-between spaces, the utilitarian functional spaces. And I think that the knock-on effects for that would be exactly all the things that there's already a lot of academic research out there about the savings it makes to the National Health Service, all right? So this isn't about like us, this isn't just about us having prettier supermarket car parks. This is about us making tangible differences to society, economic savings to society by valuing all our green spaces more, you know. And so socially, I think that, you know, there, you know, you only need to look at all the research around green infrastructure benefits to understand the importance of those green spaces I'm talking about. And then when it comes to biodiversity, you can't ignore, you know, nature corridors, you know, because quite often we might have some isolated, really valuable biodiversity, good quality green infrastructure, and the in-between green infrastructure might be industrial estates and supermarket car parks and things like that. So we've got to make that work, you know. And so I think that there's no way that they're not a really important biodiversity aspect in that regard.
Okay. Yeah. So you mentioned there about the disconnect between the landscape architects, the property managers, and the maintenance contractors. How can these relationships be improved to ensure better outcomes for the spaces themselves?
For me, that is about recognizing who is pulling the strings in terms of management of those of that infrastructure, right? And that's the property management industry. So What I would like to see is the likes of the RHS, Barley, British Association of Landscape Industries, and the Landscape Institute providing free resources to the property management industry. All right. It's not a big, it's not a big project. All right. We go, here is a tick box, good quality, horticulturally informed, generic grounds maintenance specification. All right. And they would be, they would have this for free. They could download it off a website and they can go, right. First question, how old is your development? 0 to 3 years old, right? So you need to go down this column and to slightly different generic maintenance contract, all right? And so it doesn't need to be a hugely complicated document, but essentially, but the essence of it being the landscape sector, the horticultural industry, landscape architecture industry, going to the property management industry and saying, firstly, here's the consequences of not looking after this, right? Because I think we need a bit more academic research in terms of the economic consequences of not watering plants and stuff like that. But also just saying, look, you know, we're here to work with you. Here is a free document that you can use that will, you know, upgrade your green infrastructure. Not everyone will use them, you know, but if we could get 10% more, 20% more, you know, we're going to start making an important change. You know, that's how big changes happen, isn't it? You start off small, and I think I think that would be a really easy start to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned so a moment ago. You said you start your conversation with the property management saying, "I can get you less complaints." What is it that you would say to them? You would do to get less complaints?
So, do you know? Do you know the easiest win for anyone that's running a site, managing a site like that or a portfolio of sites, would be rather than insisting on, you know, and I've read a lot of generic maintenance specifications in my time, rather than insisting on cultivate the flower bed surfaces once a year, all right? Mm-hmm. And half the time that doesn't happen anyway. And then everyone starts falling out with each other and they're insisting on, you know, my real bugbear statement in any generic maintenance specification, weed-free beds. And so contractors go, well, we've got to spray them then. You want weed-free? We've got to spray them. All right.
Yeah.
If they, rather than that, if they said mulch the beds once a year, all right, you're going to improve the appearance of them. You're going to make management of them easier. And it's a really obvious, easy thing that the tenants and residents can go like, oh, well, you know, this thing's happened once a year that is a real tangible thing that makes them go, right, there's a big thing happening, all right? And for us within the landscape industry, because, you know, we can sit and bemoan the skills gap until we're blue in the face, and there's some really good work going on at tackling the skills gap, right? But we've got to start with some easy wins, and actually that then is going to make conversations in the future easier, all right? So, you know, it's no good us complaining about roses not being pruned quite correctly by grounds maintenance companies that cover an entire country and are needing to employ thousands of people, right? Yeah. What we need to go is like, what are some easy wins here, right? Mulch the beds once a year, insist on watering the plant, watering new plants for the first 3 months, take tree stakes off after 3 years, stop planting trees too deeply. It's just like a small handful of really easy wins. And then we can progress things and we can start looking at changes that are going to be more generational. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously budget constraints are often cited as a reason for poor maintenance. So would you say those things that you've just mentioned there are realistic approaches that organizations can adopt to improve spaces without incurring prohibitive costs?
I think quite often mulching is. I think, and I have to be honest here, watering I think is probably more difficult. That's a hard sell, but I think it is doable. mulching, I think, is an easy win. Now, what I will quite often, when I'm speaking to facilities managers and property managers, is I'll go in with a few kind of basic ideas like that that are going to be easy wins. Mm-hmm. But quite often, another really easy win is to try and educate land managers away from our societal obsession with mown grass, enormous expanses of mown grass that the contractors go out between 21 and 26 times a year, and they go over it with petrol-driven machinery, all right? And these quite often, they aren't green spaces that people go and sit and have picnics on. They're just massive expanses of mown grass. So you need to do it a little bit carefully, all right? But, you know, almost always there is some expanse of grass on sites that I'm helping with where I go, right, let's have a 1 or 2 meter contour strip of mown grass all around the edge, all right? And you've got to mow that every week, all right? Or at least once every 2 weeks, right? But that needs to look sharp, all right? This whole area in the middle, all right, we can have that as a rough grass meadow, all right? If it's big enough, we can mow some paths through it. But all of a sudden, we can have something that is doing something for biodiversity, is creating more quality green infrastructure because, you know, you've got places where people can go for a walk. You've got something that looks designed so people are less likely to complain about it, all right? And then the other important thing you've got to do with that, and this is so important, and there's academic research about this, but it is, you know, it is quite hard to get people to listen to this sometimes. You need to put a sign in there saying we're not cutting our grass because of the following reasons, all right? Now, there's research about this. It takes perceptions from negative to positive by putting a sign in, just saying this is what we're doing, you know. And so you need to box it a little bit clever with it, but quite often, and I would say most of the time, I can go to a client and say, right, here are a couple of easy wins, and yet they're going to cost you a little bit more money, right? But then, look, we're going to stop cutting 60% of your grass, you know, and it's still going to look good, you know. So how much is that going to save you? And so, and then all of a sudden, they're starting to save money. But do you see what I mean? I think the important thing is easy wins and really pragmatic, tangible changes, and then you kind of build from there.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, Phil knows that I'm a huge advocate of mulch. I'm a real mulch bore. And actually, you know, that to me, that is an easy win, because if you're having to buy the pesticides and then pay for training, because you can't do pesticides without a PA6, without your licensing already, it's only going to take a couple of years before you start seeing savings. And then for some people, they've got facilities to do their own chipping, to make their own mulch. So, you know, to me, that will, you know, not so much in the first year, but eventually you'll definitely start seeing the savings, definitely. Anyway, so we have talked a little bit about how pivotal they are in biodiversity. Can you just give a few little examples of how these smaller green spaces, maybe between housing estates, can really play a pivotal role for biodiversity in these urban settings?
So in terms of biodiversity, again, I think that the big ticket item there is the nature corridors. You know, so linking up the spaces around and in between, because we know we have parks and we know we have botanic gardens and larger green spaces within urban environments. But what are joining these bits up? It's residential gardens, you know, hugely important in terms of creating nature corridors. Massively. And there's already a conversation going on about that, you know, that is, you don't need to delve too far into our world to find people talking about the importance of residential gardens in connecting up nature corridors. Really important. But I think that when I was looking into this and I did a big literature review as part of my MHort, I came across one paper from America that talked about the functional green spaces in urban environments and how they joined up nature corridors. So I think that's the big ticket item there. And I think that we're not talking about it because people don't see them as important. And I understand why they don't see them as important, but, you know, what I've been looking into and getting passionate about is the fact that they are important, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that people would take them more seriously if they were better looked after? You know, I think partly because they are neglected spaces often, people don't treat them with the respect that they actually should do. Does that make sense?
It completely makes sense, Phil. It's a great question. And it's, you know, something else that was in my mind when we were talking about, you know, reducing areas of mown grass on sites, is that something that's critical to that is litter picking. Because as soon as people start seeing litter, they then stop valuing that site. All right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
When I had a landscape contracting company, we looked after some really lovely places and some beautiful private estates. But for residential property managers, we also looked after quite a number of pretty down at heel residential housing estates in urban areas in Scotland. All right. And one of the issues I had was keeping the guys motivated when they went to these sites, because these sites where no one was going to be putting their hand in their pocket for new plants or anything like that, you know, and residents didn't value them. And so they were, you know, they could be quite demotivating to go and work on, right? But what I'd noticed over the course of a number of years, and what I always used to explain to my guys, is sometimes we'd go in on a site and there would be fly tipping happening. There'd be mattresses in flower beds, like pretty grim stuff, right? Now, we would, each month, say, we would take away, and we'd keep a record of it, we'd take away three mattresses, four shopping trolleys, you know. But 6 months later, we would take away one mattress, two shopping trolleys. And then a year later, we're like, hold on, we've not taken any mattresses away from there for you know, 3 months, right? And so, like, these are not changes that are going to, like, get any horticulturists, like, really excited. But I think they're really important, because what we've done and what the grounds maintenance contractors are able to do is get people to value the sites a little bit more, all right? And then just going back to the point about, you know, quite often, and because there's an income aspect to, you know, the areas that we were working in there, you know, we know that people on the lower income scale are interacting with nature less, right? And so again, we're getting people on these estates to, and even if people aren't aware of it, they're valuing their little bit of green space a little bit more. Because we've been going in, not, but, you know, calling it horticulture would be a big word for it. It was tidying up, you know, but it was making a difference, you know.
Yeah, it's allowing the people, the residents there, to take pride in their surroundings.
100%.
Well, it's about community, isn't it? Yeah. Community. In so many green spaces, when the community become involved, it just changes everything. People say they make friends, they suddenly find their neighbours. You've got all these little alleyways in some of the northern towns that just become these incredible kind of oasis of plants and all sorts. And then people start to congregate and they talk and they become friends. There are some lovely, happy stories, and it makes such a difference. And if you've got somewhere that looks crap, you just add to it, don't you? You know, that's the problem. But if something looks good, generally, you want to keep it looking good.
We get both ends of the spectrum in Glasgow, Kate, because we have lots of lovely lanes, you know, and exactly what you describe, you know, happens. And you go down these lanes sometimes and you see, and they're like, oh, wow, they're really cared for. And they're really enormous looking little lanes that, you know, you can't even get a vehicle down. But people have started
caring about them, you know. But we have the other end of the spectrum as well, you know, where, you know, stop degrading, and then they degrade, and then they degrade, and then they degrade. And I think that it's really important, you know, and again, this is, you know, getting into the core of what, you know, gets me a little bit excited, is that, you know, there's all these other areas that are getting forgotten, because, you know, if we don't consider tidying up the fly tipping and mattresses before we can start practicing horticulture on these sites, then actually as a society we're failing to deliver the benefits of green infrastructure, you know. And it's nuanced. Absolutely. It's difficult, and quite often these spaces don't lend themselves to getting excited or passionate about, but you know, they're important.
Yeah, totally.
So Tom, in your opinion, what's the single most impactful change that we can make to improve our relationship between green spaces and the built environment?
So I think I've talked previously about, you know, communication within the industry and between the industries. And so I think that it's not cheating to say communication and wrap a whole lot of stuff into that. Then I think that would be it for me. And I think particularly as the nature of our soft landscapes is changing with the advent of biodiversity net gain and things like this, is that how we manage our landscapes and what our landscapes look like is changing, all right? And so all of a sudden we've got the ecological industry, the landscape sector of the horticultural industry, the landscape architecture industry, to some extent the architectural industry, and property managers and facilities managers involved. Yeah. And what's happening at the moment is a slight siloing of interests where, you know, the ecologists are quite rightfully, what's most important for them is biodiversity. And the different silos that we've mentioned there, they've got their thing that they're most focused on. And actually, that's a really powerful way of working together if you can work together. And it's why in a big business you have a finance director and a marketing director and an IT director and a sales director, and they can all have their little arguments and friction, but ultimately you end up all being well, delivering a good product, right? Because you're negotiating your way forward. And actually that, you know, I can see, we're at a critical stage with that at the moment, I think. And so I think there's a lot about the changes that are happening at the moment that could either contribute to making matters worse in terms of continuing to devalue the landscape maintenance sector anyway, or it's an opportunity, all right? And actually, that's what I would really love to see. I would really love to see the landscape sector and horticultural industry stand up and go, now listen, we're experts and we're integral to the changes that need to happen in terms of not just creating a lovely new soft landscape, but making sure that that matures and develops and has the positive consequences for biodiversity and social impact that it could do in 20, 30, 40, 50 years' time.
Yeah. It's so much about people, the government, and just everyone taking horticulture seriously, you know, gardening. And I think just talking to you, Tom, you really help address that and make it a bit clearer as to why it's important. It's such a simple thing. To me, it's so obvious. And the way you talk about it is really clear. And it, hopefully people will listen and start to take it on board.
Thank you. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what you say there, Kate. And I think that we're still missing a trick a little bit, is going back to what I was saying about, you know, we to some extent, you know, it's not enough to keep explaining to people how important horticulture is. We kind of need to go, look, these are the cold hard figures. If you don't water your plants, this is what's going to cost you. If you don't respect the maintenance of your utilitarian spaces, you've got, you know, equalities issue that that you've got on your hands, you know, and just start speaking in the language of, you know,
the reality of how the horticulture industry interacts with the industries all around it. Because I think that when we start talking about cold, hard figures and social impact and things like that, that's how we get people to sit up and listen. And so I think that that's where, like I speak to you before, I think I've done this loop as a from a kind of human geographer into horticulture and stuff like that. And like, I think that's where it all kind of joins up for me is that, you know, we can't just sit in a horticultural bubble and keep having the same argument. We need to start collaborating, communicating and reaching out and all this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Well, look, Tom, I'm going to end with getting you to put your horticultural hat on now, though, and just firstly ask, do you enjoy gardening yourself? Do you have time to garden? Do you have a garden?
I do have a garden, and I love gardening. I'm a keen gardener. I have a very dense kind of naturalistic scheme, so I'm not out every weekend looking after it, and I like it that way because I like to let nature get its hand in there, and I'm like touch, you know.
Right.
Wonderful. And do you have a plant or flower that, you know, no matter how bad life is getting, it will always just put that smile on your face?
Oh, that's a good question. There's so many, but I mean, I think probably foxgloves because when they're flowering, but also their life cycle as well, the fact that they don't do anything for a year and then in the second year they flower, and the fact that, you know, there's a slight kind of fear attached to them because they're poisonous, but then they've given us this wonderful drug gets used for heart disease. And I think there's so much about foxgloves to love.
Oh, no. And they were amazing down here last year because of all the wet, that I've just never known foxgloves like it. It was just the most beautiful thing. Walking along the coast path, I was just blown away.
Fantastic.
And it does, they make you smile, don't they?
Yeah, they're the best. They're the best.
Fantastic. I guess that just about wraps things up. Thank you so much, Tom, for joining us today. It's been really fascinating talking to you and learning more about those spaces in between.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Thanks very much. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the Underground, or sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant, and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at writeobarra.com.